Okay, this is the Yecheskel Shir, Ilu Nishmos, Ephraim Shmuel ben Avram Aryeh Cohen, and Chaya Tova Bas Eliezer Mendel HaKohen. We are holding in Yecheskel chapter 11, verse 16. After chapters 8, 9, 10, and most of chapter 11 of dark words and dark predictions, we now come to the end of chapter, the last verses of chapter 11. As traditional in prophecy, the dark words come first and the words of comfort come second. And despite the fact that the leaders of Yerushalayim have claimed that all the Jewish exiles are gone forever, and they, those that are living in Yerushalayim now, are the last remnant of Israel, God now assures Yechezkel that God is going to protect all the exiles of Israel, wherever they may be throughout the world, and that at the end of the day, all exiles will return, or all exiles will have the opportunity to return, certainly. So this is verse 16. Lochain. Emar, Korma Hashem Elokim, therefore so says God, Ki hirchaktim bagoyim, I have removed them, I have distanced them from me, amongst the nations. V'chi hafitzotzim ba'arotzos, and although I have scattered them across lands, ve'hi lohem l'migdash ma'at, I have become for them a minor beis hamigdash, a minor sanctuary for them, ba'arotzos asher bo'shon, in the lands where they have come to, where they have come there, or they have come to. So this is God's assurance that however far the Jewish people are exiled, whatever they go through in exile, that God, so to speak, will be with them in exile, and that there'll be a situation, as we'll see shortly, that God will arrange for the Jewish people at the end of days to return. To kick off this explanation of this verse, we'll start off with just a quick review of this verse, as understood by both the Abarbanel and the Malbim, and then we'll look at the huge implications that this verse has for us in the 21st century. So starting off with the Abarbanel. Abarbanel says, Ki hirchaktim bagoyim. Despite the fact that I've driven you from your land into exile, and alien lands, kloma afal pishi urchaktim bagoyim vapitzotzim barotzos lo rochokum imenu. That however far you travel, however far you go into exile, and even though, as it says, vapitzotzim barotzos, when there's two parts to this, that the Jewish people have been exiled, but not only that, but when they're exiled, they don't actually get to stay together. They're scattered among the nations that they go to. In different lands, different regions, different towns, forming small Jewish enclaves. Despite all that, God assures the Jews none of you will ever be distanced from God. God will be there with you. Rather, God says, I will be a little beis hamikdash for them in the countries, the regions, the towns that they come to. Because even though they're far from the real Beis HaMikdash, which has been destroyed, the real Beis HaMikdash in Yerushalayim, the real temple there, which is the great Beis HaMikdash, nevertheless, Shom B'toch HaGoyim Eyeh L'Mikdash Ma'at. They'll be in the exile, wherever they go to, I will provide them with a miniature Beis HaMikdash. Romos L'Beis Knesios Yehoyu L'Hem B'Golas. This is a reference to the shuls and the yeshivas that will exist in the exiles, as described. The above now doesn't mention it, but this is based on the Gemara in Megillah, on the Kaf Tes. The Gemara says, Omar Rabbi Yitzchak, called Migdoshi Ma'at, all these small temples refer to the synagogues and the study halls of Babylonia. And Shehoyu Lahem Begolus, these Balel Olai, these will be places that you will be able to pray and to learn Torah in. Ve'ayei mohem, and God says, I will be with you there. Ve'ashma b'kolom, and when you go there to daven, I'll listen. Ve'atzilei miyad oyveihem, I'll save you from your enemies. Shelo yasu b'hem kliya. There'll never be a situation that will arise where the Jewish people will be totally wiped out. The Malbim adds, just on top of that, she'eshra shechinosi b'sochem gam shomo. Despite the fact that you're in exile, don't worry, God's presence will be with you in exile. V'agam shelo tishra shechinosi aleihem b'izgalia. And even though my presence will not be revealed as it was when there was a real Beis HaMikdash in Yerushalayim, God, so to speak, will be in a case of hest upon him, in a situation of he'll be hiding himself. Uba'osus of Amosim, come up a Mikdash HaGadol, and there'll be no miracles, as they were open miracles, which were daily occurrences when there was a temple in Yerushalayim. They won't exist anymore. Nevertheless, Tishra B'Seisa V'Hashkocha Mustoras. Nevertheless, God says, my providence, my protection, will watch over you in secretly. And the Abarbanel adds one insight into this double expression. Hirchaktim Vagoyim V'Hafitzotim Barotzos. Now, he says the words Hirchaktim Vagoyim, this refers to the exile of the 10 tribes of the Northern Kingdom. They were exiled into many distant lands, right through going eastwards, through Iraq, Iran, Afghanistan, India, Pakistan, and as far as China and Japan. And so that's Hirchaktim Bagoyim. The 10 tribes traveled great distances in their exile. The second expression, Bichi hafitzotzim ba'arotzos, that God, so to speak, says he's scattered you in lands. This refers, says the Barbanel, specifically to the Babylonian exile of the two tribes of the southern kingdom of Yehuda. And it's about these two tribes that God makes this promise. Ve'yi lohem lemikdash ma'at ba'arotzos asher bo'osho. God says there'll be places, I will ensure there'll be places in the Babylonian exile, where you'll basically invent the idea of shuls and yeshivas in all the regions and all the towns where the Jewish people are exiled to. And this is something that we have till this very day. It never existed in the First Temple period. There were no shuls. There was no fixed davening. There was no yeshivas. This is something that was developed in Babylonia. The whole idea of a synagogue and people coming to pray three times a day, it was developed in Babylonia. And when the Jews returned after 70 years in exile, it was something that was introduced as part of the daily life of a Jew by the Anshei Knesset HaGdola. The ideas of a shul, coming to the shul three times a day, and the creation of yeshivas, specific places where people go to learn, and that is those shuls that we have today that were originated really during the exile in Babylonia and established as part of law when the Second Commonwealth was set up, has got huge halachic implications, and the shul that God calls a shul, a Mikdash Ma'at, a small base of Mikdash. And the Ben Ish Chai, in his halachic work, this is in Hilchos Hashanah, the laws pertaining to the way a Jew should conduct himself during the year, he writes as follows, Beis HaKnesses or Beis HaMedrash, Nikra Mikdash Ma'at. The shuls that we have, and the Bote Midrashas, the yeshivas and the study halls that we have, Nikra Mikdash Ma'at. We call them, they are designated as a small base of Mikdash. Tirsiv, as it says in Yecheskel, Ve'yi lohem lemikdash ma'at, Eile bote kinesias abote midrashas. And he quotes the Gemara in Megillah, the shuls and the yeshivas, V'kosvu ha'poskim de mitzvah liyira min ha'mikdash noeg v'beis ha'kinesis. Listen to this halacha. People sometimes don't realize this. There's an absolute requirement to feel the awe of a shul and of a yeshiva as if you were walking into the Beis HaMikdash itself. Midyaraisa. And that is a biblical requirement. It's the word of God. It's Pi HaDibur, that a shul is described as a Mikdash Ma'at, and therefore you have to treat the shul and you have to treat your yeshiva as if you're in the Beis HaMikdash. And he says, these are the words of the poskim. And he's talking, you know, this is recently. This is Ben Ish Chai wrote towards the middle of the 19th century and to the beginning of the 20th century. But he says the poskim, he's talking about the poskim in Iraq, hold that there's a biblical requirement to have the awe that you would have for a Beis HaMikdash. You have the same awe that when you walk into a shul. Is that the way we treat our shuls? So this is something to bear in mind. Ulechein ro lahazir bichvodom uleshevashom ba'emo v'yiro. Therefore, it's absolutely imperative to be careful in honoring these places, the shuls and yeshivas, to sit in them with a feeling of awe and trepidation. And for those people that treat shuls and yeshivas as places of social gathering, a davening club, places to tell a few jokes, and have conversations about all sorts of things that are not relevant to being in a Beis HaMikdash, the prophet Yeshayahu warns them about God's attitude to that. And this is the first chapter of Yeshayahu. Mi bikesh zos, mi yedchem romes chatzaroi. Who asked you to come? You are just trampling my courtyard. So he says it's absolutely imperative that from this verse, that everyone understands when you walk into a shul, that you're walking into the Beis HaMikdash. And the Rambam, in his Hilchos Tefillah, the Laws of Davening, this is in the 11th chapter, he writes as follows. Bote Knesset, shuls, the yeshivas, and places of study, should be treated with total respect. They should be swept clean and mopped. And he writes that he saw in the Sefer Hasidim that Rabbi Yaakov Ben Yochor, Rashi's teacher, would polish the floor in front of the ark with his beard when he was old and unable to teach. He suffered from dementia. He couldn't teach Torah anymore, and so he became the caretaker of the shul, and he used to sweep the floor and the Aron HaKodesh with his beard. All the Jews in Spain and the West, he's talking about his Sephardim, his people, the people of North Africa and Babylonia and Eretz Yisrael, are accustomed to light lamps in the shuls, in addition to lighting lamps at night when the light would be necessary. Lamps were also lit during the day as a mark of respect to copy what was done in the Beis HaMikdash, and they would spread mats over the floor to sit on. In European communities, they sit on chairs rather than on the floor. And he says that you walk into a shul, again, the same idea. You walk into a shul, you've got to picture yourself walking into the Beis HaMikdash. Furthermore, the Panine Halacha, Rabbi Eliezer Melamed, in his Likutim, his Sefer, introduction to his Sefer on the laws of davening, he's, in order to understand, this is him, he's writing, this is contemporary, this is 21st century. In order to understand the enormous value of the shul and the yeshiva, one must first say that the existence and survival of any nation depends on its country of origin. Therefore, every nation that was forced into exile from its country of origin in a short time lost its identity and assimilated among the people of the place to which it was exiled. The only nation that remained alive and existed without continuing to live in its own land was the nation of Israel. This survival tool is the shuls and yeshivas, and they were a gift from God. And he quotes our posuk, Ve'yi lohem l'migdash ma'at, God says. I've provided them with miniature base Bote Midrash, Bote Migdoshos, small temples. The survival of the Jewish people throughout 2,000 years of exile is to a large extent thanks to the synagogues and yeshivas, since they are a kind of spiritual extension of the land of Israel and the temple itself. And every Jew who enters a synagogue or yeshiva, whether he is in the world, wherever he is in the world, gets to suck a little of the holiness of the land of Israel while he is there. And so, despite all the visible troubles, we were able to continue to maintain our national identity, the main expression of which is the belief that Hashem hu hu Elokim, that He is God, is the guarantor of our survival in exile, ve'hi lohem lamikdash ma'at. And wherever we walk into a shul, wherever it is in the world, it's as if we are walking into the land of Israel, and more specifically into the temple itself in Yerushalayim. Finally, on this verse, which is essentially an expression of comfort for the future of the Jewish nation in exile, that God will be with them at all times, a word of caution, because he says, shul and yeshiva is a mikdash ma'at, a miniature base of mikdash. The way you behave in the sanctuary of a shul has to be consistent with the way you behave inside a real temple, because the sanctity of a shul is not based solely on the fact that it is where we daven. But this is the place where the Sifrei Torah are kept, and therefore there has to be decorum in the shul. There's much more to it than that. The place where you daven is a temple. So, God, so to speak, is watching to see how we treat our Mikdash Ma'at, our shuls, how we behave in them. God wants to see whether our behavior in our Mikdash Ma'at, in our shuls, in our Bote Midrashos, in our yeshivas, is up to the level where we could be trusted to be given a real, proper Beis HaMikdash in Yerushalayim again. As long as we treat our Mikdash Ma'at, as long as we treat our shuls with disdain, as long as we treat them like a davening social club where we meet up with our friends and chat away throughout the service, then we are no better than the 25 men that Yechezkel saw in his vision, facing the sun, with their backsides to the Kodesh HaKadosh, to the Holy of Holies, disrespecting God, disrespecting His temple. Consequently, as long as we disrespect our shuls, God will not be inclined to trust us with a third Beis HaMikdash, which is a very stark warning. So here you have another reason why maybe the third Beis HaMikdash hasn't been built in Yerushalayim yet, because of the way, I'm not casting any aspersions on anybody, but generally if you walk into a shul, not all shuls, but if you walk into certain shuls, you think you're in a social club. Laning's going on, people are talking, people are talking about work, people are telling a joke, people disappear during the Haftarah to have Kiddush and to have a Kiddush club. All these things are absolutely awesome. And I'm not picking anybody in particular here. I'm just telling you the halacha. To walk out of shul when the Haftarah is going on, so you can have a cup of tea, or even worse, have a shikah, that's absolutely awesome. It's a complete disrespect. You'd never do that if you're in the Beis HaMikdash. You're in the Beis HaMikdash and the Kohenim are on the Duchen, or they're laning from a Sefer Torah in the Beis HaMikdash, or reading from the Nevi'im in the Beis HaMikdash. You would never have the chutzpah to walk out and make Kiddush and have a shikah. So all these things that are prevalent have become, so to speak, part of the way we treat our shuls, like a social event. Says the Panini Halacha, these might be reasons why God won't trust us with a Beis HaMikdash. You can't be trusted with a shul to treat it with respect. How can I expect that you'll treat the Beis HaMikdash with the respect and the honor that it's deserved. So what's very interesting is that the Ramak, Moshe Cordovero, he writes very harshly about, and we're all guilty of this, talking in shul. The reality is that there is no talking in shul at any stage. From the moment you walk into shul, you've entered a different realm. You've entered the realm of a Beis HaMikdash. There's absolutely nothing else to do in there except to connect to God. Nothing else. And I remember from my own experience, my Rebbe Zechel Tzad Livrocha absolutely outlawed people to leave during the Haftorah. Haftorah is introduced by the Anshei Knesset HaGdolah, so that we can understand what these Nevi'im are saying. We could have a short insight into what the Nevi'im were saying. And, you know, talking in shul, laughing, joking in shul, looking up at the women in shul, waving to the women in shul, whatever it is. These are all things that are absolutely awesome. And according to some opinions, it's an Issa D'Oraisa. It's a biblical prohibition. And the idea that you would take only in the modern age, the idea that you'd take a mobile phone into shul during the week, a mobile phone that's switched on, unless you're a doctor on call, that you would actually take a mobile phone into shul that was switched on, it's the ultimate disrespect. It's absolutely awesome to have a mobile phone in shul. Absolutely 100%. Unless you're a doctor on call, and you've got the responsibility to save lives, it's absolutely awesome to take an open mobile phone into shul that's switched on. Absolutely awesome. There's just no question about it. People say, you know, I use it to daven with. Well, we've got things to daven with. Something new. They call it a siddur. That's what you're supposed to daven with in a shul. And you see it all the time. You know, people finish the Shemoneh Esrei, right? And they answer an email before the repetition of the Amidah. And they answer send a WhatsApp to their friends. So the Panini Aloch is saying here, this is you do that in the Beis HaMikdash. If you're in front of King Charles, no, Queen Elizabeth's dead now. You're in front of King Charles, you get an audience with the king, and he asks you a question, or you're having a conversation with him, and in the middle you say, oh, just wait a minute, I just want to answer this WhatsApp. I just want to answer this email. Right? You can't imagine anything more chutzpahdik than that. So this idea that, you daven from a mobile phone inside, so if you're somewhere where there's no shul and you daven, you stop on the side of the road, so okay, so you daven from your phone. If you don't know, you're davening off by heart. But to walk into a shul and daven from a mobile phone, it's absolutely awesome. People should recognize this. And according to the opinion here, according to the Rambam, certainly, it would be an Issa D'Oraisa. We have biblical prohibition. So, this is the message. This is the first message. So that's the message of caution. But it's also a message of hope. That God, so to speak, says he's going to provide you, introduce this idea of shuls and yeshivas. And people don't find it hard to believe that before the time of the Second Commonwealth, when the Jews returned from Babylonia, there weren't any shuls. There wasn't any communal laning. There wasn't any communal davening. There was nothing like that. People did. People davened in their own nusach. They made up their own davening, and there was no laning. People were trusted to learn the Torah themselves or in groups, but there was no shuls. So this is the new thing that comes out of the exile, that essentially will be the survival tool of the Jewish people for the next 2,500 years. So that's verse 16. Now moving on to verse 17. God continues with words of comfort about the exiles and the people in exile. Lochein, verse 17. Lochein emark. Kama Hashem Elokim. So says God. V'kibatzti eschem min ha'amim. I will gather you from the peoples, from the nations, from the peoples. V'osafti eschem min ha'aretz. And I will collect you from the lands Asher nefitzotso, to the lands that you've been scattered to. V'nosati lochem es admat Yisrael, and I will give you back the land of Israel. So, the first thing to understand in this verse is the difference between the word v'kibatzti, I'll gather you, and v'osafti, and I will collect you. So as is normal in the Tanakh, we've got the Malbim, who's very particular about similes, about words that seem to mean the same thing. Well, God's going to gather you, God's going to collect you. Why do you use two different words which describe exactly the same thing? Says Imam, in Hebrew there's no such thing. We don't have similes. He says, V'kibatzti eschem min ha'amim, v'osashti eschem min ha'arotzos. He says, Kvar biyarti, I've already explained this in my commentary to the Sefer Yeshayahu in the 11th chapter, which the 11th chapter of Yeshayahu deals with the Mashiach, and so this pasuk also deals with the Mashiach. It says there in Yeshayahu in chapter 11, verse 12, the Noson Nes Lagoyim, and he, the Mashiach, will raise a banner to the nations, the Osaf Nidchei Yisrael, and he will collect the lost tribes of Israel, meaning the 10 tribes, Unefutzos Yehuda, and the scattered ones of Yehuda, Yikab Beitz, he will gather. So again, in that verse, you have an expression of the Osaf, which means collecting, and yikabates, gathering. And says the Barabanel, Shiesh Hevdel ben Osaf ben Kibetz. There's a huge difference between the language, the words kabates, in our verses, vikibatsti, I will gather, and the word Osaf, which occurs in our posit, with the word osafti, I will collect. So there are two completely different concepts. Shahama kabates, yikabates nifzoros. The word kabates, the word vikibatsti, I will gather, means to gather something that's close by. Like you drop something, and it's scattered in front of you across the floor, and you gather it in. Something that's fallen from your grip, and it's in front of you, it's close by, and you gather it. The ho'osef, but the word osaf, in our pasuk, the word osaf, meaning to collect, it means to collect outcasts and return them to their point of origin. Something that's not close by, something that's very, very far away. You have to go out of your way to collect something. That's le'esof, to collect something. And also, you have to understand in this verse, the Navi uses two words to describe the people, in where they're exiled to. The first word he uses, ho'amim. V'kibatzti eschem min ho'amim. I'm going to gather you from the peoples. And then it says, v'osafti, I will collect you min ha'arotzos, from the lands. So he says there's a big difference between the arotzos, the lands, and the Amin, the peoples. But Achash Arotzos Heim Rechokus Yosa Min Ha'amim. The language of Arotzos, lands, it means, again, it goes together with the Osaf, because it refers to lands that are very far away from the land of Israel. And the word Amin refers to peoples that are close by to the lands of Israel. Nations that are close by to the lands of Israel. And so he says, Lochain, therefore we can understand the verse like this. The Neged Mashikos of Lonu hi nitno ha'oretz lomo rosho. He says this verse addresses the claims of the leaders of the last inhabitants, the leaders and the last inhabitants of Yerushalayim at this stage in history in verse 15, that they believed they are going to be the only ones left in the land of Israel. And they would inherit it forever. Shakoshrim shani dochim or eila obda tikvosa. And that everyone that had been exiled up until then, the first waves of exiles from Yehuda and also the 10 tribes, that none of those exilees, those people that had been exiled, would ever return. Meshit. Therefore God replies, you're wrong. Vikibatzti eschem min ha'goyim. He said, firstly, God says, I will gather you from the peoples. Shemin ho'amim ha'karovim ha'kabetz osom, ge'ulas ba'isheni, shenikbetzu golei bovel v'shavu le'eretz Yisrael. The first statement in this verse, which is, I will gather you from the peoples, meaning from the people nearby, It refers to the redemption from the Babylonian exile that will end and allow for the return of the people of Yehuda to build the second base of Middash. Furthermore, secondly, Ba'osafti eschem min ha'arotzos. Secondly, God says, I will collect everyone. At the end of days, I will collect everyone, including the lost tribes who did not return. Those that didn't return to rebuild the second temple, the 10 tribes were still in exile, as they still are. But at the end of the end of days, all exilees, all Jews in exile, at the end of days will be gathered, will be collected from all the distant lands across the globe. And at that point, the end of the verse, V'nosati lochem es admas hakodesh, God says, thirdly, I will return the land of Israel to these returnees, lo kamosha amru, and not like you people of Yerushalayim were told by your leaders, lonu hi nitno ha'aretz lamorasha, that you will be the only ones that will own, that will keep, that will live in the land of Israel in perpetuity. You will be ones that will go into exile as well. And it won't be till the end of days when all the Jews will be ingathered into the land of Israel from everywhere. Ba'osafti eschem min ha'arotzos, from all lands. Now, I don't know exactly how many lands up to this date, in the middle of 2023, how many countries Jews have been ingathered from. I would imagine it's, 30, 40, 50, 60 lands, 60 countries. I don't know, there's Jews here from everywhere on the planet. Our current situation is a prime example of the prophecy in this, that Yechezkel is saying here. God's going to collect you from all four corners of the earth. And I will give you back the land of Israel. Well, we have experienced that. This is something that we are currently experiencing. And just notice, by the way, the order here, that there's no conditions here attached. You'd think, God said, I'm going to ingather you, and on condition if you do teshuva while you're in exile, so I'll bring you back to the land of Israel. There's no conditions here. God's saying, this is something I'm going to do anyway. Never mind whether you're worthy of it, whether you're not worthy of it. There'll come a time when I will make sure that the Jews from all four corners of the earth are ingathered to the land of Israel, and I will give them back the land of Israel. So here we are. Here we are. Tell that to somebody from 300 years ago, you've been laughed out the room. 300 years later, here we are, Ken Yerubu, nearly 9 million people living in this country. And from, as I said, there are 70 languages spoken in this country. 70, maybe even more than that. From countries from one end of the earth, from Australia all the way to the other end of the earth. Well, right across, going from east to west and from west to east. Almost every country in the world where there have been Jews scattered for thousands of years, hundreds of years, thousands of years. You'll have representatives of Jews here. India, and the whole of Europe and Africa and everywhere, every country where there's a Jewish community, they've got representation here in the land of Israel. And then God says in verse 18, Uvo Shoma, and they will come there, the end of days. And they will come, I'll bring them back to the land of Israel, they will come here, and they will remove all the detestable things and all its abominations from it. Now, exactly what this means, so there's a slight difference of opinion here how to understand this verse, and again, it's a difference of opinion between the Malbim and the Abar Benel, exactly how to understand this verse. So we'll deal with the Abarbanel first, the Malbim first, because the Malbim continues his explanation from the previous verse, starting with another Hebrew lesson. So we've got, God says that when I bring them back, they will remove all the Shikut Seha, which literally means all the detestable things, but es kod toa baseha, and all the abominable things. So what's the difference between a detestable thing, a shikutz, and an abominable thing, a toeva? So of course the Malbim tells us exactly what's going on here. He says, es kol shikutzeha, the word shikutz is a code word in Tanakh for avodah zarah, for paganism. There's a requirement. God says, listen, I'm going to return you to the land of Israel. And I'm going to ingather you from among the exiles. You've got to get rid of all the avodah zarah. When you get back, you get rid of all the avodah zarah, all the paganism that's in this country. Something that we've not done yet. But es kol toav oseha, the word toeva, says the Malbim, is a code word in Tanakh for abominable activity, which is usually sexual in nature, incest, and other forbidden heterosexual relationships, bestiality and homosexuality. So he says, I'm bringing you back, but what I expect from you when you come back is to get rid of all this nonsense. All the baggage you brought with you from Chutz Laaretz, the 2,000-year-old baggage that you brought with you, the Avodah Zarah, and I'm not going to spell it out, but there's plenty of Avodah Zarah being tolerated in this country, and there's certainly a lot of Tov Oseha, there's certainly a lot of abominable sexual activity still tolerated in this country, So we haven't really fulfilled God's condition yet, which is something we'll discuss later in the next verse. So now that the Malbim has told you what these words mean, now he explains the verse. He says, "Uvor shomo ve'hisiras kol shikutzeho. Zehoya b'ge'ila b'ay sheni she'oz hisira ha'shikutzim she'anshe k'neset ha'gdola botlu yitzrod avodah zarah." He says that this is something that was done once before already, that when the Jews came back from Babylonia, that the Jews removed Avodah Zarah, which was the corporate, what we call corporate Avodah Zarah, during the first temple period, that there was national religions. The people worshipped, there were national gods. People had the right to worship this god and that god, the Baal, the Asherah, and all this type of stuff. But when they came back from the Babylonian exile, they got rid of all that. And so much so, says the Malbim, the Anshei Knesset HaGedola bitlu yotzro avodah zarah. They got rid of the Yetzer Hara among the Jewish people for paganism. And this is described in the Gemara in Yuma, which we'll have a look at now. We'll have a look at the background to this and have a look at what happened when they returned. But just bear in mind, this is something that's a requirement for us. At the end of the day, it's not just a requirement for the returnees from Babylonia. So what they did, the Gemara, just to give you a background, all the returnees from Babylonia gathered in Yerushalayim to do teshuva for their own sins and the sins of their fathers. When they came back, the Gemara in Haroyos describes that they brought korbanos when the second temple was built. One of the first things they did was they brought korbanos. They brought 12 korbanos, chatos, sin offerings, for all the 12 tribes, for all the aveiros that they did, all the sins that they did, prior to the destruction of the first temple. And the Gemara says, this is a Gemara in Yuma on Daf Samach Tes on page 69, by Yizaku b'kol gadol al Hashem Eloheihem. They cried with a loud voice to God. And that's a pasuk from Nehemiah. And the Gemara asks, what did they say? So the Gemara says, Rav and Rabbi Yochanan said that they said, "Woe to us! The Yetzirah, evil inclination for idol worship that was one of the catalysts for the destruction of the first temple and the destruction of the sanctuary and the burning of Yerushalayim and the murder of all the righteous people of Yerushalayim and caused the Jewish people to be exiled from their land and it still dances among us. They were concerned that they were going to sink back into the ways of the nations around them and into pagan worship, which would, of course, have led to an immediate expulsion from the land of Geth. And they said, they cried out to God. This is the pasuk by Zakul Bakol Godol Hashem Eloheihem. The pasuk from Nehemiah, chapter 9, verse 4. They cried out to God, and this is what they cried out, says the Gemara. Didn't you, God, give it to us solely for the purpose of receiving reward for overcoming it? In other words, what was the point of the Yetzirah? What is the point of the evil inclination? The point was so that we could have free choice, and in relation to pagan practice, and we could be rewarded for overcoming the desire to get involved in these types of pagan rituals and get involved in all the orgies and everything else that goes with it. And the people said, we don't want it, and we do not want its reward. In other words, there's a Yetzirah, there's an evil inclination inside every human being, to get involved in pagan practice, and if you overcome it, you're rewarded for it. We don't want it. We don't want the desire, and we don't want the reward for not being seduced. As the Gemara said, we are prepared to forego the potential rewards for overcoming the evil inclination as long as the evil inclination is removed from us. In response to that prayer, says the Gemara, a note fell from heaven on which was written the word Emet, indicating that God accepted their request. In response to the indication of divine acceptance, they observed the fast for 3 days and three nights, and God delivered the evil inclination for Avodah Zarah, for paganism, to them. And a fiery lion cub came out of the Kodesh Kedoshim, jumped out of the Kodesh Kedoshim, and Zechariah the prophet said to the people, this is something those that learn Zechariah with me, we'll get to this later on. Zechariah said to the people, this is the Avodah Zarah. This is the Yetzirah for paganism. And they had to perceive it in physical form, because it's not really a physical object, but they perceived it in physical form. And they said to Zechariah, what should we do to kill it? And the prophet said to them, throw it into a container made of lead, and seal the opening with lead, since lead absorbs sound, and the Yetzirah will be mabatel. You won't be able to... the Yetzirah only for Avodah Zarah, for paganism. They followed his advice, and they were free from the evil inclination, the Yetzirah for Avodah Zarah, as our verse says, V'heisiru eskol shikut seho, that there's a requirement to remove Kol Shikutzel, all the Avodah Zarah. Now, at the time of the Second Temple, the Avodah Zarah was literally Avodah Zarah. It was paganism. There were statues and idols and rituals and orgies and worshipping trees and all that sort of nonsense. In our generation, we have different types of Avodah Zarah. And the most notable and the worst kind of Avodah Zarah is it, and the idea of Avodah Zarah is that it's a denial of God, that you've done it all, you know, you don't need God to help you out. You can use you can pray to the sun, you can pray to an idol, and the idol will help you out. And so we have our own Avodah Zarah in our day, and the worst kind of Avodah Zarah we have in our generation is the Avodah Zarah for materialism. Money. And we believe that with money you don't need God. What do you need God for? You got 200 million in the bank, so what do you need God for? Like, what do you need God for? What purpose does God serve? You got plenty of money and you can do what you like and go on a holiday and you can go on a cruise and you can afford the best doctors and everything else. So what do you need God? So we don't have the Avodah Zarah that we don't have the Yetzirah that they had at the time, that they were mevatel the Avodah Zarah, by poking the eye of the Yetzirah for Avodah Zarah for paganism at the time of the return from Babylonia. But we have our own Avodah Zarahs. We have our own paganism. We worship money. We worship materialism. We worship people. We worship footballers. We worship baseball players. Yeah, they're wonderful, they're fantastic, and we follow them, and I mean, I'm as guilty as the rest of you. We follow them on Twitter, and we follow them on social media, and we watch them, and we're in awe of them. And this is also a form of Avodah Zarah. Pop stars, models, sports superstars. Ronaldo's got 300, 400, 500 million followers on Instagram. It's Avodah Zarah. So, although the time is pointed out here that, as the Malbim says, this is something that they managed to achieve. There was no Avodah Zarah for footballers and materialism. Well, there probably was for materialism, but not to the extent that we have today. There was Avodah Zarah for the idols and the abominable practices of pagan worship. So that they removed that, and that never reappeared in Judaism again. It's never reappeared. Well, we've attracted our own types of Avodah Zarah through the ages that we brought with us. So in the Second Temple period, they managed to get rid of it. And the question is, how are we coping? We've also been returned to the land, just like the people from the Second Temple period. What are we doing? The Hesirus called Shikutzel. What are we doing to get rid of all this pagan ideology of worship, the worship of money, the worship of materialism? So the Malbim continues here. What about the other thing mentioned in this verse? That's called Tov Osel. And all the abominations. Zayyeh b'gu'ulo ha'asida she'oz yivatel yitzrod da'aroyas v'yesetoevos. So this part of the verse refers to the removal of the yitzhara for other abominable sexual activity. We can't do that ourselves. That is something we will be unable to do ourselves. And that will have to have help from God at the end of days. Talking about incest, well, incest is not something that's prevalent in our society, but other biblically forbidden heterosexual relationships certainly are, and bestiality certainly, probably not, but homosexuality and all the LGBTQ ABCDE nonsense that is taking over the land of Israel certainly is with us. That will be removed in the end of days, in the Messianic era. All that nonsense has got to go. Finished. And so that's the difference between Shikut Seha and Tova Seha. So when the Jews returned from the Babylonian exile, so they got rid of the urge for Avodah Zarah. That was never present again amongst the Jewish people. But at the end of days, so it's incumbent on us to get rid of immoral sexual activity. But it seems from the Malbim that that's something that's a very, very difficult task to remove that from the Jewish people, and we might need some help from that, from God. In any event, that's the way the Malbim reads this verse. The Abal Brunel has got a slightly different approach, and he says this verse is not talking about the return from Babylon and the Messianic era. It's talking solely about the Messianic era. And he says, keep a bond to Yerushalayim. When you come to Yerushalayim, Yesiru Mimene Kol Tov Aseho, Ba'aleihem Omer B'loshen Nista Uvo Shoma. There's a strange expression. The verse here is cryptically written about a time when, right at the end of the verse, it says, Uvo Shoma, when they will come there. And he says, "Rot Saloma shebegulo asida, gam kein yavo osom shigolo rishona kama osom shigolo va'achrona." He says, this verse means that when the Jews are finally gathered at the end of days, which is our period of history, the Jews of the diaspora, together with the 10 northern tribes, will gather together, and in the era of Mashiach, all semblance of paganism will end across the planet. In other words, there'll be no other religion. There'll be no Christianity. Islam isn't paganism anyway. But every other religion apart from Judaism and Islam is completely and utterly pagan. And there isn't any religion that fits into the idea of monotheism, certainly not Christianity. especially not in the Catholic Church, which believes in a Trinity. You read the Rambam, what he writes about Christianity. So this is the Uvol Shama. This is the language of Uvol Shama. All the people will return, and every type of pagan activity, all other religions across the planet will come to an end. And so I just want to point out again here, just notice the order of this part of Yechezkel's prophecy. This is a prophecy of comfort. It's a prophecy of that deals with the end of days, and a prophecy that deals with the fact that really describing an era that we're dealing with. This is it couldn't be more accurate in its description of the generation that we live in, a generation that has been lucky enough to have been returned to the land of Israel, and we continue to absorb hundreds of thousands of millions of Jews into the land of Israel. But what's striking from this prophecy from Yechezkel is how it's not the return to the land of Israel is not dependent on the people doing teshuvah. This is absolutely unbelievable. On the contrary, regarding the future, these last two verses that we've just read indicate that God will gather them and collect them and gather them from close by, collect them from the four corners of the earth, give them the land of Israel, and only after they arrive, Uvol Shama, as the Barabbanel says, after they have arrived there, do we find that the people will have a responsibility to do something themselves, to Heisiru as Shikud Seo, Ves Koltov as Seo Mimena. They'll have a responsibility to take away all the pagan practices that existed in the diaspora, and all these sexual improprieties that are part and parcel of the world that we live in this era of the ingathering of the exiles. I mean, it's not a hyperbole to say, you know, it's irony. This is not the Victorian age anymore, right? The Victorian age of prudence and people dressed. If you look at pictures and drawings and paintings of the Victorian era. So, you know, the women, there were some sneers about it. There might have been, you know, there might have been a lot of things wrong with the society, with the Victorian society. One thing that wasn't wrong with them was they had a semblance of sneers about them. You walk down the road and, it's in Ranana, for example, on Purim, so it's almost an Issa D'Oraisa to walk down the street. Because of what you might see, the Purim parade, and how the women dress in the Purim parade. So it's just, you can't believe what you see here in the land of Israel. So we're certainly not in the prudish Victorian age. We're in an age of social media where people promote sexual promiscuity and immoral sexual behavior, and it's normal, and it's, you know, you want a boy wants to be a girl, and a girl wants to be a boy, and it's all okay, and it's all natural. And this is what the prophet said. Ha'omen, if you want to know what the generation of Mashiach is like, the generation of the ingathering of the exiles, ha'omrim ala tov rav ala ra tov. The people of the generation will tell you that what's objectively good is rotten, and what's objectively rotten is good, and it's the way to behave. And that's the definition of the age that we're in. Who's this? Made a comment here. Irwin. I recommend, based on the message in today's share, that no one should read the book A Cubes, A Mystery of Intrigue, in which a prominent feature is the Kiddush Club and the Shabbos synagogue. Unfortunately, the Kiddush Club members solved the mystery in the mythical shul. Oh, you're the author. Alright, okay. Very good. And the shul's name is Ahavas Chinam, which is a great name for a shul. Borrows from Rav Kook, right. Okay, so that is That is something that, you know, we can appreciate. Well, these last two verses describes our generation. That God's going to return you to the land, but there's going to be problems. They're going to bring with you problems from around the world. And not only problems from around the world, but you're going to be open to all these ideas that pervade modern society. And you've got leaders that are completely corrupt. I'm not a fan of Joe Biden or Donald Trump or any political leader around the world. But it's blatantly obvious to anybody that's willing to pay any type of attention that our leaders are completely corrupt. And they'll do anything to be elected, even to support activities that go completely contrary to any semblance of objective morality. You know, they're obsessed with materialism. That's what it's all about. Anyone that's ever been to Washington and met or had any involvement in the money flow that goes through to the senators and the representatives to support certain bills on behalf of certain companies, pharma, and I mean the whole thing is a corrupt. Even Donald Trump, who I'm not a fan of in any way, shape or form, described it as a swamp, which is exactly what it is. So you got the Avodah Zorah of materialism, of money, and you've got the sexual predilections of our society, which go completely contrary to the laws of the Torah. So that's what he's saying. That's what it's going to be like. Their Malbim and their Barbanel say that's exactly what it'll be like. When you return to the land of Israel, that's what it's going to be like. And you've got to fight it. If you want a messianic era, so that's you've got to fight it. So we're up to a very famous verse 19 here. Now, God reiterating this strange order of events, which I've just described. The order of events here is very strange. That God says, I'm going to do this for you anyway. I'm going to gather you in from the four corners of the earth, and I'm going to give you back the land of Israel. And then we're going to see what you do when you get there. Let's see if you do your part of the deal, if you perform your part of the... So God's not asking us to do anything before we come back. I'll bring you back, don't worry, in good time, you'll be returned, and here we are. And now it seems that the onus is on us to do something about the way we conduct ourselves. So that's where we're up to. God says, if you do that, if when I return you, then you recognize that it's me that's returned you, and you get rid of all this obsession with materialism. You get rid of this obsession with money. You get rid of this idea that any type of sexual behavior is appropriate. If you do that, so he tells you in verse 19, the very, very famous pasuk, "V'nosati lohem lev echad," I will give the Jewish people one heart, "v'ruach chadasha," and a new ruach. We'll have to see what that word means in next week's year. Ruach chadasha, and a new ruach, etein bekirbachem. I will gift you inside of you. Vahasirosi lev ho'evan mibsorom. I will remove the heart of stone from your flesh. V'nosati lohem lev bosor. And I will finally give to you a beating heart of flesh. So this is a very, very famous pasuk. Exactly what it means, the depth of this pasuk, is something that we'll deal with next week. That's it. That's all I got to say. We're up to verse 19. And if anybody's got any questions, now's the time. Okay. I hope everyone enjoyed the shiur. As I said, we're up to verse 19. We'll continue, please God. Everyone should have a great week. We'll reconvene in the same time, same place next week. Everyone should have a week of health and happiness. I'll see you next week, please God, on Monday at 5 o'clock or Eastern Daylight Time at 10 o'clock. Kol tov to everybody. Kol tov. I'll see you in the morning. Yeah, yeah. Kol tov to everybody. I'm struggling a bit. I'll see you soon. Bye.